Talk radio.
Yeah, okay, yeah, here's the chat room. Okay, hey everybody, welcome back to another smashing hour, the Authority Smashers. Lots of stuff coming, you know, going on. Two interesting items that came across my Google Reader and another listener actually brought them to my attention were things going on at InfoShop, some stories there. One has to do with a crime think convergence in which people claiming at least to represent APOC, that's Anarchist People of Color, came in and basically disrupted the event. We can talk a little bit about that. There's another interesting piece at InfoShop, the anarchist movement is Bullocks, and I'll try to get everybody links. I just had them all open. I'm having a little technical difficulties, but Jonathan, you, or Mr. 1009, you could tell us a little bit about the struggle with the economists that you've been having.
Yeah, that's been that's kind of interesting. Well, we can start with the thing about APOC, right? That's pretty worrying event. I mean, it's not something that usually happens with anarchists. They have these racial tensions out in the open.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I was him and Han here. There's an interesting response to the story. I'm gonna get everybody links here. People aren't familiar with it, but there was an interesting response to this whole event from a member of APOC and a young woman of color who's saying, hey, this isn't APOC. These people don't represent APOC. But still we have the race up there front and center, and there's quite a conversation going on over at InfoShop. This is at Anarchist News, the one I'm looking at right now, but let me see, Smack a White Boy Part 2, I think it's called, and basically Crime Think, they had this convergence set up, I think it was Pittsburgh, if I remember right. APOC, set out to, or members of APOC, at least that's what they're claiming, that's Anarchist People of Color. And they had an open letter to white radicals and progressives, and basically they came in and said, there's not an act, get your shit out or we'll remove it for you, don't try to fight us, we're not pacifists, we'll defend ourselves. And they were grabbing people's bags, throwing them outside, all kinds of racial, go back to Europe, whitey. It was a pretty violent display, I think, anarchists against anarchists. It's disheartening.
I think obviously there's a tension there between the fact that anarchism is all inclusive, right? Racist, yeah. Sexist, political, sexual inclinations within a certain spectrum. But you don't, we also have a legacy of racism, and therefore, we've always seen black groups, groups that try to sort of reinstate some sort of equality between the races as something that is okay. Martin Luther King, Malcolm X came forth saying, well, the black man has to assert himself, the black people have to assert themselves as being, even better than the white man and things like that, because they wanted to put themselves at the same level, right? And I think, there's a place for that, but, as anarchists, I think the better strategy is to try to encompass as wide a, because then you alienate people, I think. I think that we've always had the problem in our movement of division, division between people of the different sexes, different races, even a slightly different as an ideology. So you have someone who slightly believes more in something else, so you can't be part of our group. And that's a real weakness, because let's look at the real enemy, what's going on.
Yeah, I've seen this anti-white behavior quite a bit, actually, in recent years. It seems to have gotten worse, where to be at any kind of anarchist gathering, be a white male. I mean, to be white and male, it's like the double negative to be around anarchists sometimes. You know, like when we're expected not to speak, you know, at meetings for the most part, because, and this is true, I mean, some whites, some white males do monopolize time, you know, I mean, but it becomes this delicate balancing act, whereas as a white male, I often find myself just, I'm not going to say anything, because immediately someone pulls out, you're using your male privilege, or you're using your white privilege, and it's a very sad state of affairs, because what happens, what ends up happening, like we have this thing, this crime think convergence, this is what happens, is the people who have all the best intentions in the world, they want to fight racism, they want to fight white supremacy, they want to fight white privilege, all these things, but they attack the very people who are their allies, you know, who at every level are trying to at least come to grips with these ideas, live them, you know, and fight with, you know, anarchist people of color and, you know, other people, you know, against racism and white privilege and, you know, imperialism and all these things. So instead of, like you said, instead of attacking the real enemy, they go after their closest allies.
Right,
you know?
Let's assume, for example, that the white anarchists who are working with these exclusive groups, you know, black anarchist groups and stuff. Let's assume that they still have some sort of racist assumptions that they themselves aren't even aware of, which is quite possible. Now, how do you solve that in order to fight the larger and bigger racism that you know, we have in our society? I mean, I think that...
Well, you say you grab people's backpacks and you throw them out, and then you tell them to get the fuck out.
That's just not going to work.
That's how you do it.
That's just not going to work. I mean, the way you... I mean,
it's going to backfire.
Right. So you're shooting yourself in the foot. I mean, I just don't think it's... it's not smart. It's not a smart thing to do.
I saw this. I don't think I've mentioned this really, but I'll give you an example. At our anarchist book fair here in New York, there was a talk on the prison industrial complex, and I forget what the actual name of the talk is. It's one I didn't actually take because I got there a little late. A buddy of mine, Brandon, who's an active anarchist here, he's big with prison letter writing campaign that they have for political prisoners. And so he was scheduled to talk. He didn't even know it till that morning. And there was three other women that also were on the panel. And like I said, he found out that morning, had to rush over to the Anarchist Book Fair and basically, you know, just talk off the cuff. Apparently he went a little over his allotted time. I don't think he knew. It certainly wasn't anything that he did intentionally. But immediately, you know, white privilege and male privilege, all these things were just brandied out. Every single white person who had talked in the question, you know, answer period was, like, singled out. Like, you asked a question and, you know, and it was just like, really? You know, like, you want to beat up the people who are at least trying. You know, I mean, if one thing anarchists generally can agree upon is that racism is bad. I mean, if you look through where, you know, anti-racism is a pretty strong component of anarchists, and you know, it's awesome to point it out, you know, and help, you know, your white comrades. But if, you know, you don't show up to a place like this and, you know, threaten people with violence and kick people out and tell them to go back to Europe. Like, well, you know, how's that? It doesn't help anything or anybody. It's just I'm really just kind of fed up with it, to be honest. And another thing that happened at the Anarchist Book Fair, another comrade from Baltimore area brought the same thing up in a similar vein. He said, you know, there's a lot of angry, frustrated, poor white youth in this country. And they're ignored by anarchists. You know what I mean? Anarchist groups, generally, you know, it's odd to say it because we are predominantly white. But at the same time, the poor whites, they generally don't join up with us because they show up and it's, you know, don't talk because you're white, don't do, it makes, you know, it hurts the movement, you know, and these angry, upset white youth end up going to other things like national anarchism or some neo-Nazi group or, you know, some other right-wing type radical activity, you know, because they feel alienated in these kinds of atmospheres where you know, they're constantly like, oh, you're just talking because it's, you know, you're white. Like, come on. You know?
I feel, you know, I have to say that this is sort of a trait of a lot of these radical groups, and they don't even have to be anarchists. They can even also be, you know, Marxist. But that you have this, you want to create a sort of different institution, different environment, and you end up having very sort of very high expectations, and you try to create something different, and you put a lot of you sort of look at people who try to disrupt your idea of what things should be like in a negative light. And so you end up getting this uneasy environment. You know, you can't really talk about things because you may offend somebody. I think, you know, in order to deal, especially when we start getting bigger, we have to find a way to relax and to, because when you relax and when you are able to communicate, you can discuss things. If you can't, I mean, if we can't even discuss a few things that we're doing right now, like, you know, rallies and, you know, activities. You know, what when we start discussing economic allocation? When we start discussing all the things? I mean, we can do this, but we have to work out these silly little quarrels that we have, because, you know, we're just missing out on the big picture. You know, we're only starting. And I think maybe it has to do with that fact. We're just starting. We're just starting, and this is the most difficult time. You know, let's face it, we are totally inexperienced with democracy. We get together.
Right.
We already have, we think we're independent from all the bullshit from our society, but we're not. We're trapped in the same divisive, isolated, sort of alienated ethos of our society. So we have to overcome that. And I think that once we get that past that first stepping stone, then we'll see that it's not as hard as we think it is.
Definitely. The other, maybe to move on to something a little, I think it's kind of in the same vein. I don't know if you read this too. This is anarchistnews.org, and I think someone in the chat room posted a link already. But it's the anarchist movement is Bullocks, and it's this Terry Morgan, who kind of recounts his experience in the anarchist movement going back to the early 80s. As a working class anarchist, and to kind of sum that, have you read it, Jonathan? This 1,000 Nights.
The post that from Tyler.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did read them. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So you're familiar with it, and any thoughts?
Well, he, if I remember well, he mentioned that he told his parents. This is the person that I'm thinking about. He told his parents that he rejected anarchism and wage slavery, and he was asking, why did I tell that to my parents? Like, I don't reject these concepts, but I sort of felt the need to tell my parents that. And he said, why do you think I said that? And my impression of that was that it's pretty simple, is that we all have the sort of desire to not be, I mean, it's hard to be a radical. It's hard to have those thoughts because you are separate from other people. And you want to, there's that little voice inside of you that tells you, reject all of this and join the herd. If you join the herd, you'll be more comfortable. You won't have all these inner and outer conflicts. And so that's why we always have these sort of escapades, or whatever you want to call it, where we reject everything we stand for. So, well, fuck this, and, you know, we embrace the status quo, or sometimes even worse, we embrace, like, some fascist sort of ideas, you know? It's pretty sad, but that's the reality. It's hard being a radical.
Yeah, I'm wanting to know if we're talking about different pieces now. I think we are. The one I'm talking about, I don't recall that part, at least. But it basically, you know, he grew up as a working class anarchist, and in the 80s he recounts all, you know, different things he was involved in, and he didn't just reject it out of hand. It was just, it was the middle class nature of anarchism that I think really bothered him. You know, the blind activism. Let me get a quote here. I think we're talking about a different. Maybe it's a similar, story, a similar vein. Let me see. Okay. You're talking about Tyler. Chanchi just kind of figured it out, I guess. You're talking about Tyler, who listens to our show and was left a comment on the blog, I think. Right?
Yep. Yep. Well, okay. I mean, I personally think that looking at the middle class nature of say the current anarchist movement, you say, well, you look at these people and you say, well, they're mostly middle class, or they're mostly this, or they're mostly that. I mean, that I think that if, let's say that in the future we have an advanced anarchist movement or society, we'll look back, we'll laugh at these things, because these are just sort of like, you have the mushrooms cropping up, you know, and some of the mushrooms come out in certain areas of the forest, and right now we're saying, hey, all the mushrooms coming out of this side of the forest, that's not fair, or that's not this and that. But once the whole forest is full of mushrooms, then you're not going to be worrying about where they came out first, you know, and that's sort of what's happening now. I mean, you have all these complaints, oh, you know, the whites, the middle class, the this, the that, and you know, in the end, we should overcome all those things. I mean, and let's not forget, I mean, we have people like Kropotkin, Bakunin, some of these powerful minds that contributed to the movement. They came from aristocratic backgrounds, not even middle class, but upper class.
I just sent you a link to it. It's actually a very good article. And I tried to simplify it too much. I mean, it's not just like the middle class nature of the anarchist movement, but it's the separation and of the middle class anarchists on the one hand and the working class that they're always talking about trying to help. That separation, which is a generalization to be sure, but it's true to a large extent. It's something that like a guy like Andrei Rubicek speaks of often. This idea of accompaniment, where you have the middle class privileged people, you know, seriously accompanying the people that they're trying to help. And that seems to be more or less the aim of this paper. Like in the conclusion, he says, the aim of this work is not to dispirit working class activists, but he wanted to share his experiences of a decade within the anarchist movement and explain why his enthusiasm wore off, and why, you know, anarchism is in shambles. And his intention is to encourage working class anarchists to question why they're involved in such a movement. What he says is he wants to drag working class political activists out of the anarchist mire and get them in touch with the working class. So I'm kind of, you know, it's kind of a long article. I'm trying to squeeze a lot in there, but it's really, it's not a rejection of middle class people by any stretch. But it's this separation, this divide, where the working class is almost in the way Alexander Berkman would talk about the working class, you know, before he shot Frick. You know, it was always, you know, the people, the capital P, and it was really abstract. And at that point, Berkman and Emma, they didn't really have a lot of contact with the working class. I mean, they were working class, but, as Alexander learned in the 14 years in prison, the working classes were much more complex and beautiful than he ever dreamt they were, you know, but at the same time, they were much more fallible and human and, you know, everything else. So I think that's what he's talking about. It's an interesting read. I'll put a link in the chat room.
It's a constant struggle because we are divided. Some of us are more privileged than others. Some of us are working. Some of us are unemployed. Some of us are part of a union. Some of us are not part of a collective. Some of us are part of a collective, and so we can. And obviously, we don't have the consciousness that we would have in an anarchist society, in a developed sort of anarchist movement, and so there's constant attempts to bring us all together, to break some of these barriers, because that's sort of the way anarchism should work, that we always try constantly to improve things, but also because there's the danger that, you know, we will sort of have an authoritarian structure after a while, that we don't we allow a certain group of people to gain more power than others and so on. So yeah, these are all valid attempts, but it's a fine balance between trying to solve some of these problems and not seeing the bigger picture, which is the capitalist and the government coming down on our throats. So you know, it's true, we have to be conscious of both things at the same time, but let's not lose sight of the big monster here.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And I just did put the link in there. People aren't familiar with the story at anarchistnews.org. The anarchist movement has a ways to go, right?
Sure. You know, and this sort of takes us. You know, we were talking earlier about how difficult it is to really understand these large social structures, and these are really complex events, and it's not easy to figure them out. And I got a little taste of that just recently because, as you know, I'm working on a documentary, and I, you know, keep adding new things, so I keep delaying the time of release for the first draft. But this latest thing that I added, I realized that I needed an explanation for the rise of globalization, for the rise of finance capital, which some people may not know, but finance capital is the sort of the dominant form of capital right now. And since the 1970s started growing pretty fast, and before this, and that led to sort of like slow growth, to speculation, to all these things that made capitalism that drew capitalism away from its so-called golden age. So the golden age of capitalism was from like Second World War to about 1970, early 70s. Then you had the sort of switch to this other form of capitalism, which is more liberalized, but of course you still get state protection for the rich. But you know, I try to ask Ferguson, who's a, you know, very good economist. I said, you know, why was there this switch to finance? And I proposed an answer, which is the answer that I found in InfoShop in the FAQ, which was basically that the so-called golden age of capitalism was with its welfare states, with its sort of more egalitarian growth of you know, salaries, higher salaries for people and stuff, that led to a revolt against authority. You know, these people started so the working class was getting out of control, and you had the 60s after that, you know, the revolt against authority. So as a natural reaction against this, you know, a section of the capitalist class took power, or, you know, took higher power, which finance. Why? Because finance, I mean, and also the fact that people were getting paid more, according to the FAQ, meant that the capitalists were passing costs onto consumers, and this led to inflation. Prices were higher. And so anyway, so in order to combat this sort of situation, apparently, finance capital became the new power, and you had a more liberalized economy where you could pit workers against each other in different countries, and where you you could fight this this inflation, which was caused by working class power, by all the means available to finance. And anyway, so I put this question to Ferguson, and I said, you know, what caused the rise of finance? He couldn't tell me, and I was amazed. He said, seems to be a very basic question. You know, what caused this change? He didn't know the answer. And then I asked some other economists, Steve Keen, which is supposed to be a pretty, well, I mean, he is a very important economist and one of the best, in my opinion. And he didn't really know the answer either. These are difficult questions. And when you get to sort of large social structures, the answers are not easy to figure out at all. And certainly the books, with all the propaganda that you've had over the years, they're not going to provide you with a straightforward answer.
Yeah, you know, Richard Wolff, in the video that I uploaded from the Left Forum, he was one of the opening speakers. He's a Marxist economist, and he explained it pretty well. I'm going to actually put some links in the chat room if anybody wants to check out Richard Wolff kind of discussing this. He really goes more into depth in this two-part video that I put up. He goes more into the aspects of the financial crisis itself. But he talks about the rise of, you know, the financial sector. You know, it's interesting to me when economists, when you ask them, like, there's no doubt these are complex questions, but when you ask people who are you would think would be in the know, it's very kind of revealing, I think, as to the real pseudo-scientific nature of science, supposed science like economics. They really don't know.
I asked another guy in my building who's got a PhD in finance, right, and business and finance, and I said, well, what cost it? And you know what his answer was? He said, well, in 1973, there were these two guys that came up with this equation, and then investors figure out they could make profit from this. So he's saying the single equation, the single paper, obscure paper that came out somehow caused this whole social upheaval and change. And I mean, I think it's much more reasonable to assume that deeper social causes were at the root of this.
In some ways, don't you think it was a response to the democratic surge of the 60s?
That's
the thing. One of the things I've been talking about a lot is that democratic surge really scared them. And one of the ways you do that, like you said, is you're able to pit workforces against workforces. But the problem you had in the United States was people were organizing across color lines. I know everyone's going to call me a conspiracy theorist, but, it's no coincidence that right after Martin Luther King, really started to talk more about class and race, he was executed, there was a real coming together, I think, and it scared him. And how do you do that? Well, you start shipping the jobs overseas. And that was not just something they wanted to do, but it was also made possible by the rise of computers and this ability to, rule a company, 12,000 miles away and, in a much more efficient manner, at least efficient.
Right.
Ordinary.
I mean, so far it seems that the factors that led to this was, number one, the fact that working class people were, quote unquote, too comfortable. After Second World War, you had an economy, so you had a welfare state, people, you had growth, the growth of people's sort of income.
That welfare state, though, was a direct result of the democratic surge. I mean, it wasn't something handed down by capitalists either. Public wasn't that docile.
Right, but just apparently, okay, so you had the Great Depression, and then you had, and you know what they say, Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself, because they when you have these this horrible situations in the economy, the capitalists face either revolution or they have to either choose between fascism or instituting welfare measures or some other means of control. So apparently, in the 40s and 50s, you had sort of a rise of the welfare state. You had economic growth, but also you had a very conservative sort of mindset, that sort of led. That was a strong factor in the 1960s revolt against all of this. This sort of conservative, authoritarian mindset, and maybe there's a way to tie in all these factors to account for the rise of finance. Maybe all these things were factors, but it's hard to know. I'm just guessing here.
Well, is finance really like ever completely out of the driver's seat? I mean, it's such an important component. Obviously more so now than ever, but it's always been a major piece of the economy, and I don't know.
Right.
I
mean, these are complicated. I mean, and they because before there was more regulation, right? And what Keane told me is that the experience of the 40s, 50s, and 60s allowed people to forget about the Great Depression, to forget about what happens when finances deregulated, and that, and in my opinion, coupled with the fact that you had all these other pressures coming from the working class, from the revolt against authority, and furthermore, the rise, like you said, of technologies that could make it more feasible to get information across borders and stuff. Those were factors that maybe led to the rise of finance. So, but
yeah,
who knows? Who knows? These are complicated questions.
They certainly are. I'm always skeptical of those. Maybe I give the ruling elite too much credit, but these ideas that, they just forgot. I mean, you know, they have these, like, think tanks. I mean, it's not like they're in want of resources or, you know, the time to think about these things. And the idea that, you know, within a few decades, they just, oh, gosh, you know, we totally forgot that regulation was important.
Also,
or is it just, you know, the nature of capitalism, you know, the nature of capitalism is to maximize profits. And, of course, the state's job is to make sure this crazy game keeps going. You know, meanwhile, the very entities that are being regulated usually end up regulating themselves. And so little by little, they start pulling off regulations because they're like, oh, we can make, you know, we can increase profits even more by doing this, you know.
What's
and it's the state's job to come in and, you know, bring it back in into order.
What I was gonna, what I just remembered was that what another important factor is that even though economic growth was slower from the 70s on because finance, you know, all the speculation and stuff, the elite did quite well. So as far as elite profit goes, the elite profit in the 1970s on was as good as before. So for them, it didn't really make much of a difference. I mean, if the people who really manage the world are getting the same chunk of the profit that they were before or more, it doesn't matter whether overall the economy is doing worse, as long as they're doing good.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, that's why we're in the trouble we're in.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Anyway, so you have any other news you want to discuss here?
Trying to think off the top of my head.
What?
Go ahead.
Oh,
I thought you were going to
say. Yeah, I was reading here about North Korea to free U.S. journalists after meeting Bill Clinton.
Yeah, well, Bill's got power, man.
Those
powerful dude.
Those evil North Koreans.
Korean people.
Oh,
man, I don't know if there's anybody more evil than North Koreans.
Man,
they scare me. I don't know about you.
I'm really scared. But yeah, I wish we would do the same thing with all some of the people in Guantanamo and all these secret prisons around the world. You know?
Or even the not so secret prisons. That'd be cool, right?
Oh yeah, like the 2.3 million in American prisons.
Yeah, that'd be a nice start. You know. Or we could start by releasing all of our political prisoners. How about that?
Yeah.
You know, I think Peltier just went up for parole this past Tuesday. I think we all know what the results of that are going to be. We've got well over 100 political prisoners. Yeah, I mean, it depends on how you define them. But, you know, I think all 2.5 million of them are, for the most part, political prisoners. You know, there's a small fraction of them that are probably seriously violent, and you know, we would have to do something with them. But I mean, it's such an infinitesimal percentage. You know, the majority of those people, you know, I mean, a lot of that, it's all drug, it's all the victimless crimes, right?
Let's face it,
drugs.
Someone
wants a substance, and, yep. Yeah.
The biggest criminals draft the laws, right?
Yeah, I've been trying to have this discussion with a guy, and it's like, the idea is just so ingrained in people, really, that, this is a philosophy student, but, which makes it even worse. But the idea that laws are, like, really, as flawed as they may be, they're, like, designed with good intentions, you know? They did their best, and it's, like, a really naive view of laws. J. Edgar Hoover said it best, I think, and he said, you know, the primary purpose of law is order. That's, you know, maintain the, you know, the status quo. Justice is a secondary consideration, and justice is very expendable. You know, laws, you know, they're not designed on any kind of notion of good or justice or, you know, fairness. You know, they're there to make sure this whole machine keeps running the way it's supposed to run, to protect the minority of the opulent. So, it's,
I remember that there was a very famous quote by Karl Marx where he actually talks about the system of so-called justice that we have, and and let's see if I can find it here. But it really it talked about how, okay, I have it here. Let me read it. It says, the civilization and justice of bourgeois order comes out in its lurid light whenever the slaves and drudges of that order rise against their masters. Then this civilization and justice stand forth as undisguised savagery and lawless revenge. The infernal deeds of the soldierly reflect the innate spirit of that civilization of which they are the mercenary vindicators. Says the bourgeoisie of the whole world, which looks complacently upon the wholesale massacre after the battle, is convulsed by horror at the destruction of property, of brick and mortar. So what he was talking about after the Paris Commune, and he was talking about how, you know, the law, the people implementing the law, were the biggest murderers. They were the biggest criminals. And, you know, and you saw when the slaves of that order, when the drudges of that order try to implement some real justice, then you saw that you saw what the real system was about. And I think that's a very important insight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think it's something that I think most people, if they've had any experience with the legal system, kind of know. You know, 95% of all the crimes that our police are fighting are crimes against property. You know, I mean, that's what they're set up to protect. You know, yeah, I mean, they may pull a cat from a tree or do something good, but that's not their main goal or main aim. That's not why we have police and laws and this wonderful system of government.
So, Dave, would you care to answer some of these questions? There's some questions that are...
Oh, you got questions? Yeah, yeah.
So, right
I'm
here...
I'm sorry. My desktop's a mess right now. I'm, like, trying to... I'm not seeing anything.
Is Charchi... Is Charchi connected to the radio show?
Yeah, he's on. We could bring him on air.
Yeah, okay. Because I knew he was, because I hear that dreaded microphone noise in the background. You know.
Oh, do you?
I do. I do know his microphone makes that, but it's okay. But anyway, he's...
I thought I had him muted. My desktop is a complete disaster right here. Go ahead. What were you saying?
But anyway, these people are asking these questions about... Because we spoke about last show, about the having a third party, a Green Party, and whether or not Capital would allow that to happen. And he says that I painted a doom picture when I say that businesses could pull out their capital or even institute a coup d'etat in the United States if a more leftist party was put in power. And so what do you think about that? I mean, I personally think that in order for even to break the duopoly that we have, you would have to have some social changes that you know, and then maybe you could actually maintain a Green Party. But if you put a Green Party right now and by miracle put it in power, the media would immediately start attacking it, and the entirety of the corporate structure would come out against it, because it's just not, it does not reflect the business consensus, which right now dominates politics.
Yeah, honestly, it's hard for me to speculate on that. I mean, we're so far from having a third party in that kind of prominence. I think the best showings we've seen was the early 90s with, what was his name? The real crazy Texan guy, the billionaire, Ross Perot. Yeah, Ross Perot, and then maybe one of Nader's early showings in like 2000 or 96 was a pretty decent showing for a third party candidate, and we're still talking fractions of a percentage. And you know, I don't think Nader even got to 5% of the vote. It's so hard to get on the ballots in so many states. I mean, he spent all his time just trying to get on the ballot.
What would happen if
by miracle? Yeah, I mean, as far as what would happen if by miracle some people would ask me that, like, you know, what would happen if Nader got in? Well, nothing. You know, I don't know if that's the role of third parties at this point. I can't even imagine, like, you know, that happening. But as far as the, you know, people want to expend their political energy in some way, I mean, I think one benefit, I guess you could say, of, like, say, someone like Nader running is he does get issues out there that aren't going to be talked about by the mainstream candidates, you know, and how marginalized he gets, of course, is another topic. But he does talk about important things, someone like Nader, or, you know, a guy like he's one of the
Kameho.
Green Party candidates. Peter Kameho, yeah.
He's California. Dead, you know that?
And, you know, Yeah. But I mean, people like that when they get their, you know, they do something for the political process. I mean, I don't know. I guess I hear what the person's saying. It's like a doomsday thing. The capital's not going to flee from this country. I don't really see that as being a real threat, you know.
Well, I mean, I think.
And again, we could go back to a Bretton Woods type system where, you know, we democratize the state by instituting measures on capital flight. You know, I mean that. You know, that's
right.
Something we could do as a society.
It's not that it is impossible, but that's one of the things I'm going to talk about in the documentary, how elections, the candidates with the most cash backing them and the most corporate media coverage backing them are usually the ones that win. I mean, this is just a fact, and that's something that Ferguson proves. But you mentioned Ross Perot, and I remember you made a video, kind of funny video, maybe a year ago or so, and you spoke about how Ross Perot was one of the last candidates who actually mentioned the word capitalism. Remember that?
Right. Yeah, that was capitalism. It's no more. We're all about free markets. Oh, don't we have a great clip about Abolition of Markets by Michael Albert that Chomskyan uploaded?
Yeah,
do we have that?
We should play that. Maybe we should play that.
Being a market abolitionist. This is a thing. Oh gosh, I should have cleaned. I clear my desktop. Problem is, right now I've got so many different windows open, and it's like a nightmare. oh man, I got way too many windows open. I should get a ticket for this or something. I don't know. Somebody's come organize my desktop. I just had the damn thing up too. Here we go. I'm a mess today. Sorry, guys. Yeah, so this is Michael Albert. I'm being a market abolitionist, and we'll talk a little bit about it afterwards.
You ask what a market abolitionist is, and you ask me that because I've used that term in describing myself. And the reason I use that term is because, well, the term is usually used with respect to slavery. So a person is basically saying, if we go back to the time of slavery, person is saying, well, I'm an abolitionist. I want to get rid of this institution. I think this institution is horrendously anti-human, that it is horrendously destructive of human potentials. So I believe we should get rid of it. We should abolish slavery, and we have to replace it. The person, if it's early in the campaigns against slavery, isn't thinking it's going to happen tomorrow, but they still are for abolishing slavery. Meanwhile, they're for, you know, all sorts of different demands and programs that are occurring in context of the fact that slavery still isn't abolished. Okay, so I'm a market abolitionist in the same sense. We have markets in most places in the world, certainly in the United States, the allocation system is markets. I believe it should be abolished. We should replace markets with a different kind of allocation. Why? Well, markets, I think, are perhaps the single most destructive human creation since the dawn of time. In their overall impact. What do they produce? They produce a war against all. And in that war of each against all, a great many lose. So, for instance, even in the United States, which is the richest country on earth, largely due to ripping off many other countries that are weaker, in the United States there are 30 million poor people. 30 million. There are 7 million homeless people. That's not an allocation system which is sort of distributing the responsibilities and the benefits of economic activity in a humane fashion. You can't even remotely think that if you have a population of, I don't know, 280, 300 million people, 30 million of them should be poor, and 7 million of them should be homeless, and a much larger number than that should be constantly on the edge of insolvency, and that's a sensible allocation of the benefits of production. Nor can you think, for instance, that it makes sense for huge, huge amounts of the social creativity and talent and energy of a population to go into producing things that are useless or that are damaging or that are harmful. And yet markets do that all the time. It doesn't make sense from a human point of view to divide up work the way we do in a way that sort of ensures that about 80% of the population is doing just rote and tedious and repetitive work and just has to learn how to endure boredom and take orders. But markets produce that division. So markets have all sorts of ill effects. Another one that's dramatic is the advocates of markets would say, well, it's not a perfect system. Nobody thinks it's a perfect system, but it's the best of all possible ones, and it's pretty damn good. It does a pretty good job of ascertaining the relative values of things, and they just keep repeating that. Well, imagine a engineer who said, well, I did a reasonably good job of figuring out the tolerance that's relevant to the bridge or to the building, and I was only off by a factor of 10 after all. In other words, I said it was 1 and it was 10. Well, take the price of oil or gas. If you actually factored in all of the social costs and benefits of the production and consumption of a gallon of gas, it should cost way, way more than it does, not less. Because what's not taken into account is the pollution. What's not taken into account is the destruction of the climate and the resulting effects that will be gargantuan on people's lives. And as a result, the wrong decision is made. The same, I mean, there's a million examples that you can take in which markets misprice everything. They misprice in a way which biases the direction of the economy to be antisocial, to advance the few to the detriment of the many. And they create a kind of a mindset of a rat race, of trying to get ahead at the expense of others. Nice guys finish first. If you're nice, if you care about others, you're at a disadvantage. If you're in a workplace and you care about the environment, you say, I don't want to harm the neighborhood in which I am, you're at a disadvantage compared to any workplace that's willing to operate more cheaply by spewing its garbage into the neighborhood. So you lose, and you go out of business. And so pretty soon you stop doing that. You learn to behave in a totally egocentric, totally self-serving manner. And that's what markets produce. And, you know, so I want to abolish them in the same way somebody would say who lived in a dictatorship and who didn't think it was going to go away anytime soon, but would still say, if asked, if they were honest, well, you know, of course I want to abolish dictatorship. Of course I want a society in which people are free and can express themselves and so on and so forth. We don't have it yet. I'm working for it. But maybe we'll get to it, or we will get to it. Well, that's what I say about markets.
Excellent piece. Thanks, Chomsky, for uploading that today.
Thanks, Chomsky. Yeah, I...
Obviously, this Michael Albert fella hasn't been watching any YouTube videos, because I can tell you he's Austrian, guys.
He doesn't know anything about economics.
No, these Austrians. Do you know about these Austrians? These Austrians are no joke, dude. They figured the whole thing out. Lock, stock, and barrel.
How can this guy say this?
Free markets rule. Free markets rule.
He's rejecting. He's rejecting the almighty market. How can he do that? I mean, can you believe this guy?
I don't know.
But that's freedom.
To me, it sounds like a guy. Yeah. To me, it sounds like a guy who tried to initiate violence against us.
If you reject the market,
he tried to initiate violence against us. Yes.
If you reject the market, you reject freedom. The market is freedom. It's anarchy. It's everything. The market.
Right.
Isn't that? I mean, how can you reject it? It doesn't make any sense.
I know. It's funny to joke around with that, but the market anarchists that we run into on YouTube are very much of that mindset. They can't even. I was just watching a video by the guy Stoltz we talked about a couple episodes back. Ryan, I think is his name, he's gotten to the point where you can't actually be against markets. Like what Michael Albert's saying is just like nonsense. Like you can't actually be against them because it's just impossible. It's a really interesting argument. It's like whatever I'm for, you can't be against.
Well,
you
I
can't
mean,
be against anarchism because I'm an anarchist.
Yeah, I mean, once you take a certain framework of what humans are like, of what, you have a certain conception of what freedom is, and then you say, hey, you know, if you can't let me trade my labor for your this or that, I mean, that's, you know, then I don't have freedom. I don't have the freedom to be a slave, basically. But see, and I always go back to this when I talk to these people, is that does the system that you advocate result in non-hierarchical results? Does it lead to a participatory, non-hierarchical environment? And the truth is that it doesn't. I mean, you end up like And no, what's the solution, for example, to pollution that market so-called anarchists advocate? Well, okay, their answer to that is a world based on selfishness. That is, you own every square inch of the planet. Now, if I own this square inch of the planet, that means that if you want to pollute, you'll have to pay me. Now, that's not even... First of all, if I pollute, that has world consequences. And since nobody can own the whole world, any form of pollution doesn't just affect the square inch that you own. It affects the entirety of the planet. So you can't get around this. You need collective decision making, and you're gonna get it whether you like it or not. If you deny it, you'll get what we have today.
Way to go, Jonathan. Yeah, way to go. You know, throw the tyranny of the majority all over me. Me and my carrot trading factory.
Right, and that's what we were discussing earlier, and that is that the tyranny of the majority happens when you get that herd mentality, and that herd mentality happens overwhelmingly under minority rule. So the tyranny of the majority happens under minority rule. That is what the tyranny of the majority is. When you have tyranny of the minority, then you get the herd mentality. Look at the biggest massacres in history. Look at the biggest massacres caused by that herd mentality. They happen always when a certain class of people, whether they were capitalists, whether they were Nazis, whether they were Stalinists, whatever they were, they controlled the majority, and the majority acted like a herd. That is the tyranny of the majority. So in order to avoid the tyranny of the majority, you need to get rid of the tyranny of the minority. That is the biggest insurance policy against the tyranny of the majority. But they don't want us to look at the tyranny of the minority. They want us to exclusively believe that when you have participation, when you have democracy, then you'll get the tyranny of the majority. That's a reversion of reality.
Well, the thing you're failing to understand is it's not the tyranny of the minority. It's the tyranny, it's the minority of the opulent. And they're opulent, they have opulence because they're smarter than us. Right? Isn't that how it works? They're smarter and
right.
They work harder.
I mean, yeah.
They definitely work harder. We all know, yeah. I mean, George Bush has certainly worked harder than I ever have. And that guy is really, he's really put in a lot of hours. These people work hard, so...
Right.
They obviously were able to pull themselves up. Yeah, well, they're able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. You know, the problem is my bootstraps are too weak. You know, they keep breaking on me because they're made in China.
It's your fault.
Yeah. I need an American-made bootstrap by a union-working American. Go America.
That's it. But,
It's just too much, you know. The markets, one of the things I like to talk about, is just what markets do to us. Really, they bring out such antisocial behaviors because they put us all against each other, you know. I mean, you look at our society, all these get-rich-quick schemes and, people are constantly, if you're really trying to make it in a society, you're constantly trying to think of how to screw somebody else over. Right, you're trying to think of something that'll cost you a nickel to make, but you can sell it for $500 a piece, and literally, that's what it does to us. It pits us all against each other, you know. Whether I'm fighting for someone else for a job, or there's 100 of us fighting for a position in this economic crisis we're all going through. We're all fighting, you know, to get whatever little scraps we can off the table. If we're in any kind of business, we're constantly trying to think how to screw people over. I love that Michael Albert talks about that, because I think for far too many people that even considered like markets and capitalism, markets in and of themselves are something that people kind of think of is, they're just so natural. You know, it's like, oh, we couldn't have a life without markets. You know, it's the only way, price mechanisms, that's how you figure out what something's value is, and all these things that are really more an element of faith than science. So, I love that Albert does speak on those things. And again, thanks to Chomsky for uploading that interesting little bit. I don't know. Yeah, I have some Albert up. I know Chomsky does. Do you have any Albert on your channel, Michael Albert?
I've been reading him for a long time.
Dale.
He's an excellent
you're fired.
Economist. I think everyone
you're
should
fired.
Read a little bit of Yeah, I am.
I think you should upload a Michael Albert video. That's what I think.
Yeah, and in fact, he's actually on the documentary at the end. But, you know, I wanted to talk about...
He better be.
I wanted to talk about someone, that, you know, there was this guy who was telling me that you know, he hires people, he's got this little business, video production, and that he sees these other people that he hires as partners. And what I told him is that to whatever extent, you know, you have a partner type relationship with the people you hire, that is undermined by the forces of the market. Because, I mean, of course, we know that Walmart, Best Buy, all these corporations call their employees, their wage slaves, they call them partners or associates, right? Try to sort of make it seem like it's a voluntary. But I told them that, you know, I said, well, there's three reasons why this label either doesn't apply or is, you know, pretty quickly undermined. And that is the fact that, first of all, the capital and the means of production are controlled by a minority. And it says, this forces wage laborers to put on a veneer to pretend they willingly engage in wage work. And they often internalize that sort of veneer. It says, in other words, if the work for a boss or else ethos was not in place, for example, because of participatory and societal assurance of food, shelter, and healthcare, you know, we could all participate in these sort of things. You and I may engage in a video project because we're interested in it, and if there's profit to be made, it may be split according to either need or useful effort and sacrifice. And that type of society would much closely reflect individual will than wage labor. So that would be one factor. And the other factor is that the owner has, by the fact that he's, number one, paying the wage laborer, and number two, he's under pressure from other capitalist competitors and the sort of materialistic environment he lives in. And, of course, he's also fearful of his own demise. He has a pressure to exploit his employees. I mean, this is the pressures of the market. So to whatever extent you want to be a partner with the people you hire, it's just you know, it's just tough not to have that sort of hierarchical relationship in a market system. I think that once we move to a more participatory, a more humane system, then you can have these sort of, you know, like, people need things. Like, if I need somebody to take care of something that I can't take care of right now, I need to hire them and I need to do all those things. But maybe in a future society, you'll have people who help others and because they want to, and who don't have to fear that they'll starve to death if they don't engage in this sort of wage labor that now we, you know, is the sort of dominant social relationship.
In the future, robots will do all the work and they'll eat people. That's my guess.
Yeah,
and
I guess
the proletariat.
That wouldn't be a bad thing, you know. If robots did most of the work, the problem now is that if a robot takes your place as a carpenter, right, you're left without a job. It's not like society saying, "Hey, let's share in the fruits of the profits made by these robots." They're saying,
The robots
don't have a job.
Eat us, though.
Oh.
No, well, I don't need a job. I just got eaten by the robot. Yeah, see? That way it works out pretty good. Like, instead of getting laid off, you just get eaten, and then the robot, like, picks up wherever you left off. So you're ending wage slavery, which I'm sure you're for, and you're seriously liberating the workforce. I mean, they're eaten, which kind of sucks, you know? But, you know, they're free. So that's, you know... So I think it's a win-win situation. I'm all for the as a serious note, I just read I think that it was the Pentagon. This is serious. I don't know if you guys read the story, but they're working on or have developed a robot that actually would eat corpses. It would fuel itself by eating corpses on the battlefield. I'm not kidding. That's
man.
Like a true thing. Yeah. Does that sound nuts? I think I read that on InfoShop. I'll have to look at that, but yeah, it's robots in the military. Crazy, you know? Like, eating corpses. Like, if there's no corpses around, I'm sure it'd just kill somebody, right?
Wow.
So, but yeah, that's it for the show, guys. Boy, it always goes so fast. So, but hey, everybody, thanks for, you know, checking in and trying to be a little more organized next week. It's always a struggle, but thanks everybody for tuning in. And
do you want to end with a song? Do you want to end with a song, Dave?
Yeah, we can play something here. Let's, I'm such a mess here with my desktop here. It's ridiculous. Oh man. Okay, my blog talk. Okay. Jeez, my switchboard. There it is. Okay. How about 5 million ways to kill a CEO? Because I don't think it's something y'all need to think about. There it goes. Eric, peace, everybody. Oops. Oh.
Slap him up and shake him up and then you know. Let him off the float and bait him with the dough. You can do it bump or you can just go. Get out this way. Find me a place to get a CEO. Slap him up and shake him up and then you know. Let him off the float and bait him with the dough. You can do it bump or you can just go. What you waiting? On the turf debating how to get it percolating. You working, you while we happy just to work today. But I'ma slap him till my blood starts circulating. Do you think that elasticity? Did they cut off your electricity? Did you scream and yell explicitly? Force the boss into complicity. I'm a white talk sizzle, but I'm such a pistol. Rolling dope, ain't rentals to your residential. Broke as fuck, even little quit, no utensil. Gonna teach pimp class with a whole credential.